Greetings, welcome. Normal disclaimer, you know, this is our personal opinions. This is not EFF's policy or procedure. Oh, geez. It is on. Geez. Okay. This is our personal opinions. You know, not EFF's. It's being taped. If you like to tape, enjoy. It's also being taped by EFF. All right. Pretty much the panel's beliefs are, we're going to introduce, we're going to make a couple of comments about our beliefs, and then we're going to make this a giant Q&A, because I believe your questions stimulate interest, and pretty much we're here for you. All right? Who's going first?
Let's start.
Ladies first.
Ladies first.
Oh, I love that line.
Hi, my name's Christina. I am a criminal defense attorney, and one of my areas of interest is the ways in which people are concerned how Bitcoin may or may not be used in less than savory enterprises, and so I'm happy to answer questions about that.
Hey, put those mics about 1 inch from your mouth.
Okay, whenever I talk next, I will be sure to speak up. Okay, thanks.
Jeff Garzik, I am a Bitcoin core developer, one of the five or six core developers in the world. We work on the Bitcoin core protocol, make sure that the distributed entity known as Bitcoin doesn't collapse and the money along with it. Outside of that, in general, my beliefs are pretty pragmatic, me being an engineer, so I like to talk more about technology than beliefs. Bitcoin, I think, is sort of money 2.0. It's really the future. There's so many facets to it that you can't really get into in an introduction, and I hope y'all will ask us about it, but we're really building the future here.
My name is Kevin McInturf. I've spent about 16 years working in the financial technology space, including time with a traditional merchant processor doing credit card transactions, and also spent some time working with BitPay, the leading merchant processor for Bitcoin. And primary focus there was helping to set up a network of partners around the world that are helping to spread adoption of Bitcoin and get selling to merchants in, around the world.
My name is Stephen Pear, and I'm the co-founder and CTO of a company called BitPay, and we do Bitcoin business solutions, primarily payment processing, but other types of services that businesses can use to leverage the Bitcoin network.
My name is Peter Friedman, CPA. We discuss pretty much handle virtual currency, income taxation, and certain issues in regards to the legality of Bitcoin from a U.S. perspective. All right, who wants to go first? Who's going to create more
questions?
Oh, she's going to create more questions.
No,
you're talking
no.
Criminal.
So you can take one from the audience.
Anybody want to start off?
I'd like to start out with a question. How many people here have actually used Bitcoin or have Bitcoins? Okay. Great. Gets more every time.
Yeah.
Yep.
Okay.
Hello. Can you hear me?
Yep.
Hello, my name is Sean Wilkinson. I'm a senior at Morehouse College, a computer science major. Thank you for all the work you guys have done in the Bitcoin space so far, and look forward to seeing some more stuff from you guys. My question is in regards to the new payment request system. One of the kind of problems for, I guess, developers, people who work with Bitcoin, is the documentation is just a little bit iffy. It's not all the way out there.
The code is the documentation.
Say that again? I didn't hear that.
The code is the documentation.
That's true. So my commits so far have just been kind of cleaning up the docs folder. But as far as the payment request system, can you give us an idea of how that would work? Just for a kind of a developer overview?
You want to take that?
Yeah.
Well, wait, sure.
Make sure everyone knows what the payment request system is.
The payment request protocol is a new protocol for exchanging payments in the Bitcoin system. So payments today work by creating a transaction, digitally signing it, having your wallet digitally sign it, and then broadcast it to peers. And then as that payment gets broadcast through the system, eventually the recipient, their node on the network, will receive the payment. The payment protocol stops using the peer-to-peer network for transmission of the payment, and you have a direct communication between the sender and the recipient to exchange the payment transaction. So that's basically how it works. And there's the payment request encapsulates what address you want to pay to. It encapsulates various bits of meta information to go along with the payment. Somebody that wants to collect a payment, their wallet will generate a payment. That with, I think we just lost. And they'll communicate that with they'll generate a payment request, send that to the sender, the payer, and then their wallet will generate a payment and send it back to the recipient. I think both of them broadcast it on the peer-to-peer network.
So one more little addition to that. So what's the minimum amount of information that you need for that to make it work? Is it just like a public address? Because one of the things I'd like to be able to do is use kind of a credit card system. This is just a prototype that I'm working on, where you would have the same kind of swipe your card thing, and that would start the payment, and they could accept it or whatnot on their phone. So again, this is just starting the payment. This doesn't store any bitcoins or whatnot. Or would you need more information to get that?
That's a pretty in-depth discussion to talk about how to try to do a credit card-like payment using right. Bitcoin. It's not trivial. People are working on it, but it's...
Excuse me. Could you wait for the mic? That's all I'm asking.
Thank you. Hi, my name is Carrie, and I've noticed recently that the Feds have started kind of cracking down on Bitcoin to an extent as an unregulated currency. I'm kind of wondering, do you kind of have a feel for where they might try and go with this in the next couple of years? You know, how hard they're going to try and make life for users of Bitcoin?
Yeah, I don't know if you want to handle that from the CPA.
I'll handle it from the CPA. You can handle it from the attorney end. Which is why we're separated, by the way. Have you noticed this?
Fight to start out up here.
You go first.
Well, I think that it's going... There's a couple things. One of the things is that I think that it's going to be in some ways handled significantly like cash, right? If I make a transaction, go to a bank, and I make a deposit of $10,000 in cash, that has to be reported to the federal government. I think that some of the tracking and the monitoring of that for the purposes of preventing money laundering, drug trafficking, things like that, I think is going to be handled pretty much the same way that they handle cash, because it is pseudonymous, and I don't have, you know, a nice little check with my name written on it, my social security number. So I think that they're going to handle it from that perspective. It may also wind up looking a little bit like we have regulations for securities, something perhaps, I don't think it would obviously fall under the SEC, but something similar regulated by some sort of an agency. But those are kind of government agencies that are a little bit slow to get started, and sometimes they're a little bit too fast to get started, but to get that working the way that it needs to is going to not be an overnight thing. So
from an IRS perspective or a tax perspective, there are regulations and codes in place in regards to virtual currency exchanging, that is the ability to be exchanged for US dollars or for any other recognized currency. You do transactions, they're potentially taxable or not taxable. I don't see the government's doing anything other than what's already there. I mean, we have anti-laundering issues from a tax perspective. But I don't see new regulations coming out. I think that it's going to be a reinterpretation of what exists. And that's the position in Europe also. They've pretty much said, we have enough regulations. Somewhere it's going to fit. Okay?
Yes. Yeah, I just add one more piece to that. I think that there's been a lot in the news talking about how they're cracking down on Bitcoin. In reality, they've really not cracked down on Bitcoin at all yet. What they've done is they've cracked down on people who are abusing Bitcoin to do obviously and blatantly illegal things. So in some cases, it's been illegal because people didn't fill out forms right. In the case of Mt. Gox thing, I'm not a lawyer, but that's my read on it. And in some cases, because people are literally money laundering with it, and they're going to continue to stop people who are either trying to run illegal businesses or use those businesses in illegal ways. And I don't think there's any question about that. I think what's going to be more interesting is to see as they try to make it look more like a traditional banking system, you know, how are they going to do that, I think is going to be the interesting question. You know, and, you know, I know that one thing Stephen's talked about a fair amount is, you know, what's the best place to regulate? It's at the points of entrance and egress into the economy, right? It's as you exchange fiat currency in and out of the Bitcoin economy is a perfectly reasonable place to do that.
I think you regulate the users and the uses of the technology. It's perfectly reasonable to want to have an anonymous transaction when you go to Starbucks and buy a coffee. You may not want them to track your purchases and spam you, right? That's a rational, reasonable thing. Other types of transactions, if you're buying a car or land for significant amounts of money, it's pretty reasonable to expect there to be at least a know your customer policy or know who you're transacting with in case there's an investigation needed, in case there's something illegal going on. And then there could be reporting requirements on certain types of transactions. So you regulate the uses and the users of the technology, the businesses and the individuals, and set expectations on what their responsibilities are.
I don't know whom this forum was aimed at. All these questions so far have been, to me, way over my head. And I didn't know if you were planning to give any discussion about what Bitcoin is, how it works, who did it, why, what the current status of it is, or any other general overviews before you got into the technology of particular coding or something like that. But if you were going to, I'd certainly appreciate that. And there may be others here who don't know those general bits.
Sure, absolutely. Bitcoin is fundamentally a virtual currency. It's a virtual private currency, which means that there's no government backing it, no government supporting it, there's no central bank. And furthermore, there is a limited supply, so it's intentionally the money supply of Bitcoin is intentionally modeled after resource extraction, such as pulling gold out of the ground or pulling coal out of the ground, in that initially when you start out, there is a lot that's extracted, or in Bitcoin's case, created. But over time, less and less are created until 21 million Bitcoin limit is reached. And at that point, no more Bitcoins will be created ever. And now, how does Bitcoin sort of work or support itself? Well, fundamentally, you have something called Bitcoin mining, which is just the word that we use for transaction validation. So we pay, anyone in this audience can download some software and start validating Bitcoin transactions. Every single Bitcoin transaction in the world is broadcast to everyone in the world. And so it's sort of like you've heard of in the media, I'm sure, Swiss bank accounts or something like that. The user experience with Bitcoin is something like that. You don't go to a bank, you don't have an account name. What you have is fundamentally a number. And that's what people see when Bitcoin transactions are broadcast. And so if I'm sending some Bitcoins to Kevin here, everyone in the world would just see 1234 coin worth one Bitcoin went over to this address, 5678. And so all you see is a whole bunch of numbers. Now, how does that play out in the real world? Well, you can download software on your phone called Bitcoin Wallet or on your PC, which can receive money wherever you are, anywhere in the world, over the internet. And that's sort of Bitcoin's fundamental value. It's pure digital money. There's no paper cash. There's no paper trail. There's no one with a marker trying to make sure that your money isn't counterfeit. It's all governed by mathematical rules. And as long as those mathematical rules are followed, then there's no counterfeiting. Now, why do people follow those mathematical rules? Well, it's a self-reinforcing system. If you help validate everyone else's Bitcoin transactions, then you're really performing sort of a community good and helping everyone stay within the Bitcoin network. So it's a very, very complicated concept. What is essentially simply a virtual currency, probably the world's first successful decentralized virtual currency. And so, you know, it breaks a lot of people's brains. Where's the central bank? Who controls it? How do we control it and manage it if no one's steering the ship? Is it the world's first digital organism? Because you have just all these cells all over the world interacting with each other. So it's sort of reinventing money, and it's one of my favorite things to do is confuse people by describing exactly what it is.
Yeah, I'd like to take a step even further back and just kind of introduce the whole concept briefly. Here's a little bit of trivia. Does anyone here know what the world's number one virtual currency is? It's the U.S. dollar. We have been dealing with virtual currencies for probably 50 years. The difference that I would say between the U.S. dollar and Bitcoin, well, there are two differences. One, it uses cryptographic technology to make sure that payments are secure. And number two, it's decentralized, meaning there's no individual that can actually change the supply of Bitcoin, right? Compare that with the U.S. dollar. So I think between 95 or 97% of all U.S. dollars are virtual. That means there are two kinds of dollars that exist. The physical kind, the ones that are stamped on pieces of paper, and then the other kind are the ones that exist in computers, purely in databases at the Federal Reserve. So they're bank account balances at the Federal Reserve. And I think 95 to 97% of all dollars are the virtual kind. So we've been dealing with virtual currencies for 50 years. We just haven't thought of them in that light. So Bitcoin started in 2009, or it was launched in 2009. And the real breakthrough of Bitcoin was enabling a true two-party transaction to occur over the internet. And that means you can download some software, and I can download some software, and I can transfer value to you over the internet without needing a third party to be involved in that transaction. So that means you don't need a PayPal, a MasterCard, a Visa, or any bank.
Federal Reserve System.
Or the Federal Reserve System. You can have a true two-party transaction over the internet. That was a fundamental computer science breakthrough that enabled that. And you can go read, the inventor's name was Satoshi Nakamoto. His identity he's kept his identity hidden, so nobody knows who he actually is. But you can go download the white paper, and if you're a computer scientist, you can read that, and you can understand why Bitcoin is huge. And that's what got me into Bitcoin, was when I read his white paper.
We have a question right here.
Are you satisfied? Mm-hmm. Kind of?
Partly. I still wonder, somebody created this, the people who created it, there was nothing, and then there were bitcoins that had value.
Yeah, they come into
it. I wonder where that value went to. It was traded for, the bitcoins that were created went somewhere and had value at that point. So
They're getting created constantly. Every 10 minutes, there are new Bitcoins getting introduced until it reaches a cap of 21 million Bitcoins. The rate of introduction decreases over time. So it's the software that you run that secures the network. That software, by running that software and running algorithms that sync up all the computers around the world on the definitive sequence of valid transactions, the people running that software get rewarded with newly created Bitcoins for running that software. So they're securing the network, and they're getting paid with Bitcoins to secure the network. That's how the currency is getting introduced. And that transaction that I described, that true two-party transaction, that transaction cannot happen unless you have Bitcoins, right? I can send you, you can download software, I can download software, I can send you Bitcoins, but I've got to have Bitcoins to send, right? I can't just send. You know, it fundamentally requires Bitcoins to have that kind of a transaction. And that's what gives Bitcoins their value. People go out and say that I need Bitcoins in order to have this kind of a transaction. So they go out and they try to buy them, they work for them, they run, they help secure the network, they obtain them somehow. And that's what fundamentally makes Bitcoin worth something. That's its intrinsic value. And it also happens to be the same thing that gives all forms of money their value.
What about PCI compliance? Because you're talking, sorry,
yeah.
So you're talking about a currency, you're talking about okay. transactions. Yeah. You started out with peer-to-peer, and then you move into a direct line, it sounds right. like. How are you dealing with PCI compliance with this type of currency?
The answer is we don't. Because
why?
Because you don't have to. The PCI compliance is something that exists in the credit card world to protect your individual information, right? Because when you go to make a credit card transaction, what do? You take your credit card out of your pocket, and then you hand that to the cashier at Best Buy to buy your $20 DVD, right? So you're basically taking access to your $20,000 line of credit, handing it to that cashier so they can take $20 out of your account. That card has all the information it takes to pull that money out of your line of credit, right? The difference with Bitcoin is it's a push transaction, okay? When you originate, you're pushing money out of your account to a target address, and there's no information about you or how to pull money out of your account included in that transaction at all. So companies like BitPay don't need PCI compliance because we don't store our customers' data.
Yeah, I would say in addition to that, it's really cool because if you don't do your job in securing your computers against hackers and theft, then somebody breaks in and steals your bitcoins, guess what? They've stolen your bitcoins. They haven't stolen your customers' information because you don't need your customers' information for the transaction to occur. And that's the way it should be.
I got two questions. First thing is when someone actually buys the money, where does the actual, you know, because I'm sure, you know, when you first make that transaction, whether someone's paying, I don't know, PayPal, cash, where does that money actually go to? I know you said some of it, the bitcoins go back to some of the developers, but where's that, I guess, that investment where people are spending money to buy it, where does that money actually go to?
Well, we could start by describing one of the first transactions known. One of the first commercial transactions. Somebody bought, I think, two pizzas with bitcoins. So he said, you know, this was in the very early days, and he said, I want to buy two pizzas with bitcoins. And so he found somebody else who was willing to take the bitcoins and then arrange for the delivery of those two pizzas. And so the guy that arranged for the transaction to take place, he took the bitcoins on one side, he turned around and paid the pizza company their money to deliver the two pizzas to him. And it was a little bit difficult because it was actually an international transaction. I think the guy actually doing that was in Sweden somewhere and trying to figure out how to get pizza delivered in somewhere in the U.S. And he paid 10,000 bitcoins for those pizzas.
Current day ball.
Somebody made a profit.
The way all bitcoins came into existence is you run software that secures the Bitcoin network, and you get rewarded with brand newly created bitcoins. So the people that run that software, they have the bitcoins, and you know, you have to convince them to give you their bitcoins somehow, you know, by trading them for something or whatever.
For two pizzas.
For two pizzas.
I hope he kept his
bitcoins. Hope he held those coins.
Of course, that is a taxable transaction when he decides to bring it into the Swedish economy and exchanges it for Swedish dollars, which we all agree. Yeah.
But yeah, at a basic level, I think it's, you know, the point is that a Bitcoin fundamentally only has a value that someone else is willing to pay you for it. Now, right now, there are a couple ways to get Bitcoins. You can buy them at an exchange, which is where you log on to a website and buyers and sellers of Bitcoins are matched. Or you can go to a business such as, you know, that has a Bitcoin ATM, and you can put in dollars and it'll spit out Bitcoins. But fundamentally, all those Bitcoins originally came from the transaction validation service fee that transaction validators or miners were paid. And the value, the economic value, you know, there's no central point that says these Bitcoins, a little bit of that money is going back to developers. Whoever generated Bitcoins in the past 10 minutes, they can sell them to whomever they want on the free market, keep them, hoard them, destroy them, whatever they want. And the sum total of all those individual actions around the world of all the Bitcoin holders, that's where Bitcoin's value comes from.
the free market.
Okay, I have two questions. Firstly, as I understand it, mining is basically you set up your computer and that computer solves small bits of problems. What is the bit miners actually solving? Like,
Well, there's something called a cryptographic hash. That's a mathematical equation or function where you give it a piece of data, like say a Word document, and it gives you a small string of data in return that you can't reverse to go back to that Word document. That's what a cryptographic hash is. And so the SHA-256 cryptographic hash algorithm is what every transaction validator runs over and over again, literally a billion times a second, trying to find a certain cryptographic hash that's below a very, 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 very large number. And if you find that magic number, then you just solved a Bitcoin block and you're rewarded with 25 Bitcoins.
Yeah, and I would add to that that all that work that they're doing is basically to synchronize the global Bitcoin ledger, the sequence of valid transactions. And what that means is that they are what make it impossible for me to send Bitcoins to one person and send the same Bitcoins to another person. That's what they're doing.
And secondly, what is you guys' opinion on the anonymous marketplaces, most notably through the anonymous web browser Tor?
Using Bitcoin.
I'll take that one.
Yeah, everyone's looking at everyone else up here.
Go ahead.
From a legal perspective, there's going to be a panel on NSA, and they're collecting all the data, so perhaps that is slightly relevant to just thinking about the data that you're giving out on the internet. But in terms of anonymous transactions, my understanding would be that if I want to remain completely and truly untraceable, I would need to go with like some cash to somebody and go, okay, I'm going to give you cash and you're going to give my anonymous account a Bitcoin. Otherwise, I can go to any of the companies that sell Bitcoin, and somewhere I'm going to need to give them some sort of a credit card number or bank account number. So with enough effort, some of them could be eventually traced back to an individual person. Now, through the website, Tor is something that I will leave to somebody, to the more technical people. But you know, so it is generally pseudonymous and not entirely anonymous, unless I do something in the real world, like only pay with cash and never ever use anything. Does that part make sense? So I think that would be one way that if I was if I really didn't want any of my transactions to be ever traced by anyone, that would be how you would need to do it. So from a legal perspective, I mean, that really wasn't a legal question or answer.
From a legal perspective, it's illegal, right?
Yeah. No, wait. to do anonymous transactions is not illegal.
Right, because
The Silk Road is.
Because yeah. I could buy anything with just cash, and that would be an anonymous transaction. So that would be, you're right that I don't think buying or selling something anonymously is illegal. It would be perhaps what I'm buying that would be illegal, or how I got my funds would be the illegal part.
Yeah, there's a fair amount of confusion around the issue, I think, just judging from the interactions between BitPay and some of the people who tried to set up accounts with BitPay. They want to talk about, oh, well, it's Bitcoin, so you have to be anonymous in what you do. If it's Bitcoin, it's got to be anonymous. Well, that's not true. First of all, the entire ledger for the entire history of Bitcoin transactions is public knowledge. Anybody can go look at it. Now, there's no names on it. It's all a bunch of hash addresses. But ultimately, it's all out there. So if someone who's diligent enough can find information in that blockchain, can go and dig through it and learn things. So there are countermeasures people are taking, things like mixing. People will take Bitcoins and put them into a bunch of addresses of other people's stuff and mix them together and try and make it more anonymous. But ultimately, it may be anonymous or almost anonymous to do transactions in Bitcoin. It's not anonymous, and it won't be anonymous to do business with companies that deal in Bitcoin.
Actually, the lack of privacy in Bitcoin is probably the biggest issue facing Bitcoin. If you can imagine, let's say, a company like Apple and a company like Google, and Apple's buying a bunch of LCD displays from Samsung. It's not going to be very tolerable for a situation to exist where Google could reverse engineer all of their transactions and figure out what kind of business they're doing with Samsung. So that is an issue that it's a double-edged sword, right? The privacy and anonymity can be used for illicit purposes like the Silk Road, but all of us need that privacy to, you know, protect our financial information from being reverse engineered by our neighbors or our competitors or whatever.
And I'm just going to make one comment. The comment that I'm going to make is you can have as many anonymous transactions as you would like, but if you generate a profit from a U.S. perspective or from an EU perspective, it's taxable. Just because it's anonymous doesn't mean that you don't report it on your income tax return. Okay? So don't confuse the term, it's anonymous, therefore it's not taxable. It's anonymous. I support anonymous transaction. If you generate taxable income as defined, you pay an income tax on it.
And a couple things I would add about Tor too is, number one, true anonymity is really, really, really hard. You can very easily compromise yourself through actions in the real world, and so you can have Tor set up and your software is perfectly secure, and then you mistakenly post a Bitcoin address on an internet forum that's vaguely related, and so boop, you just compromise your anonymity. The other thing I wanted to add was more a news item that came by in the past 24 hours. The number of Tor nodes on the internet worldwide has more than doubled in the past month. No one knows why.
I think Prism might have something to do with that.
I'd like to know, if you wanted to participate and become one of those nodes, where do you find the software and some instructions on how to set it up?
Bitcoin.org. You can. It's all of this is open source, and that's actually very important. The source code is open for any engineer or any person to examine and gain your own trust level with it. That's how we all on this panel initially download the software. And if it was just a closed source binary, we wouldn't have trusted our money with it. But it was open source, so we were able to look at the algorithms, look under the hood, convince ourselves that there was no double spending problem. And then we went to bitcoin.org, download the open source software, and you just run it on your local computer. If you're behind a firewall, you want to drill a hole for port 8333 into your computer. But just download free open source software, and you're a node on the internet.
Okay, and one very short, simple yes or no question. Do you know if there is or soon will be a book, something on the order of Bitcoin for Dummies?
Yes.
Thank you. I'm going to try to get to all of you in order.
Hi. Who decided that there would be a 21 million Bitcoin cap? And I guess what happens when all of these nodes that are earning, like let's just say 25 per transaction or whatever, when that stops, I mean, who's going to regulate how that stops?
Well, Satoshi decided that the guy that wrote the original software decided on 21 million. Bitcoin would have worked on one Bitcoin, or it would have worked on 21 trillion. The number was sort of arbitrary. I do think there was probably some thought put into it in terms of how quickly it would reach dollar parity, meaning when Bitcoin would be worth $1. Because I think that's sort of a psychological thing, even though it's kind of meaningless. And then in terms of the function, the 25 bitcoins every 10 minutes, that cuts in half every 4 years, and that's also built into the software and into the protocol. If you download the software and you modify your version of the software so that it doesn't follow those rules, the entire rest of the network will just ignore you. So that's how that limit is enforced. So it's actually, Bitcoin is a protocol like HTTP, like SMTP for email. And another example of a protocol I like to sometimes give is the UCC, which is a Uniform Commercial Code, right? That's a different kind of protocol. That's a protocol written down, in human English instead of computer code. But it's also a protocol. And Bitcoin is no different in that regard. The protocol is operated by computers and software, but it's fundamentally a human protocol. And it's, the people operating and running Bitcoin nodes, they choose to participate in that protocol.
Just a couple of other things. Bitcoins are divisible down to 8 decimal points. Mm. So millis, mickeys, satoshis, right? So the fact that you're dealing in whole bitcoins doesn't really matter. You're going to be dealing in very small fractional bitcoins, and that also gives you a lot of leverage to use them. The other thing is that the miner fee disappears after 21 million. I don't know if we got into that, did we?
Yeah.
Yeah, so the miner fee is going to go away. That payout that you get.
The initial block reward.
Yes. Initial block reward, 25 bitcoins now every time you solve a block. That's going away over time. But people who do transactions in the Bitcoin network can also reward the miners for prioritizing their blocks. So that income goes up as the other income goes down. So there'll continue to be incentive even after that 21 million, after we hit the limit of bitcoins in the network.
Okay. Thank you.
I have more of an economics question about the currency. I know the supply is predictable. It's not super predictable, but it's mostly predictable. But the demand for the currency certainly isn't. It would be difficult for me to use a currency that the value changes daily, and I'm certain that corporations that are purchasing and selling assets would have a greater difficulty using Bitcoin rather than the U.S. dollar.
You use U.S. dollars.
Well, I understand.
Therefore, it fluctuates every day.
Yeah, it does. I guess my question is, as everyone else, if it is to happen, begins to adopt the Bitcoin, you could have thousands of adopters a day. What do you do when there's a great influx of adopters? The demand certainly sharply increases, or
price goes up. So BitPay is a merchant processor, and we take all of the currency exchange risk off of merchants, so they can actually price their products in dollars and get paid out in dollars, and they never have to hold bitcoins, and they never have to deal with exchange rates at all. BitPay just uses the Bitcoin network to make sure we have a secure, irreversible transaction. One of the ways I like to describe Bitcoin is that it's the most counterfeit-proof form of money mankind has ever invented. And when you think about it, and I consider credit card fraud a kind of counterfeiting. You can consider how easy it is to counterfeit a $20 bill or even gold to lace it with tungsten. Bitcoin's more secure than all of those.
The EFF actually for a while there had stopped taking Bitcoin donations, and they take them again now, but one of the things that was in their press release whenever they announced that they were going to stop taking them until some of the legal issues with Bitcoins were settled, they said that they had received such a large number of them that they were concerned that if they just unloaded them onto the market, that they had enough that it would change the value of the coin. So what they did was they released them or kind of sold them back slowly or donated them back, I think is really how they wound up doing that, slowly. So I think that there's people that have a large number of them seem to be aware of the impact that they have on the market. I'm assuming that not everyone's going to be quite cautious about them as EFF was, but I think that it's just like with any currency, it seems like it would wind up being self-regulating.
Yeah, absolutely, and you have an economic incentive to not crash the market because your bitcoins have much more value if you don't do that.
Right.
So everyone collectively who holds bitcoins has that same incentive.
You guys have already elaborated on the fact that you could have 21 million bitcoins or one bitcoin could still work because you can divide it down, but I really don't think that 21 million bitcoins in the perception of the way people work is a big enough number. I mean, if we're going to start dealing with femto coins, it's going to be hard for people to understand what they're doing. And don't you guys think that the 21 million is a very small number?
I think that conversation about kind of the mental block around spending fractional bitcoins and what that feels like to people who are used to dealing in dollar bills, that conversation has been prevalent in the Bitcoin community for a while now. And there are pushes from some folks in the community to have the wallets, the various tools that you use with Bitcoin, recalibrated so they're dealing with microcoins or millicoins instead.
Even dividing by 8 doesn't sound like enough.
Yeah. Oh, dividing by 8 is plenty.
Yeah. It's more than the world economy. So.
Yeah, it's more than the atoms in the earth.
Yeah.
Sorry. When you talk about how Bitcoin is based on the free market, to me that seems a little wary considering the recent issues with recession and greed causing, you know, problems with communities. I mean, I'm a teacher and I saw how people slashed budgets for schools because all of a sudden the economy crashed. So for me, I'm very wary of free market because I see it as a like people being too greedy and not thinking about the others around them. And that's that to me, in some ways I like regulation because it's like an oversight. Like, you know, don't go too crazy. Like, do what you want to, but at the same time, here are rules and things that you should try to follow so you don't trample on other people.
Just as a commentary about regulation, one of the greatest regulations was the mortgage-backed securities. Very well regulated. You had the federal government, you had state agencies, you had the SEC, and at the end of the day, pretty much everybody can point to the mortgage-backed security business falling apart as a fundamental reason why we have economic issues today. Regulation doesn't mean safety. Regulation means paperwork, compliance, but that's all it means.
And regulation doesn't come necessarily exclusively from government either. Right. We all regulate each other in various ways in our lives. Not all of it's laws.
I just have a few quick questions about the count. You said there are 21 million cap. Do you know about how many there are now?
We all look.
Under 12 million, I think.
Yeah, about 12 million. You can go to bitcoinwatch.com and get an exact count.
Okay, and you mentioned something earlier about destroying bitcoins. What if in the future there are 21 million bitcoins and someone decides to destroy 1 million? Does that mean there will only be 20 million or will there
yep.
be another?
Yeah, they're gone.
Okay.
And they go to Bitcoin heaven.
Every day, by the way. I mean, okay. people who crash hard drives and don't have backups of for their keys into their wallets, those coins are gone to Bitcoin heaven. They're
so
gone.
Eventually, the cap will be less than 21 million.
Yep.
There's okay. already less.
And the cool thing about that is that takes supply out of the market, so somebody loses those Bitcoins. The net effect of that is the wealth dissipates to everyone else that's currently holding Bitcoins. There's no central issuer that wealth transitions back to.
Just because we're running out of time, can we limit one question per person?
Okay. And just one more quick question.
wait. Not fractional questions.
Okay.
Perfect.
All right, I have one question that might be beyond the scope of this discussion, in which case I'd have another one. But cryptographically, if heaven forbid there was ever a proof that P equals NP, would Bitcoin explode?
I have no idea.
No. No. Would it speed up the process of Bitcoin mining?
No.
And we'll go to our next question.
Beyond, yeah, this is a little bit beyond the scope of the entire audience.
The secure hash algorithm doesn't get broken if you can factor prime, if you can factor big numbers.
There's already collisions with Google or SHA, so you know they every year like they can double what they can break in terms of both SHA and D5, and that's why government's raising the requirements of the system. So there is some level of concern that there's going to be collision, and over time those can be more easily created.
Now I'd be
more worried about the hardware catching up.
If there was a problem, you can always upgrade the algorithms that are used in Bitcoin, and everybody would want to do that because they would all be incented to do it.
You had said that there's only 21 million possible. Is that right? 21 or 25?
21.
And then each Bitcoin can be broken down into 8 decimal places. Mm-hmm. Is there anything in the? I mean, I understand on its face right now it's subject to the laws of scarcity, but is there anything in the program that prevents each and every Bitcoin from essentially becoming pi? I mean, as more people want them, will they just continue to add more decimal places to each Bitcoin?
Well, it's certainly possible to add additional decimal places. That's been discussed if Bitcoin just, you know, every Bitcoin is worth like $1 million or something like that. It is, you know, well within the economic model to add additional decimal places.
So it's not subject to the laws of scarcity.
Well, it's still, I mean, one Bitcoin is still one Bitcoin. You just divide it up into smaller and smaller pieces.
So they're still produced at the same rate and same quantity.
How do you guys feel about alt currencies like Litecoin and Primecoin coming on the scene and the effect that they might actually have on the market of, you know, electronic currencies?
They're cute toys.
One thing you have to keep in mind about this is Bitcoin is a social network, right? So there is something called the network effect. So, I mean, I don't know what else to add to that.
Well, I took a fair amount of these inbounds coming into BitPay at one point, asking about, well, why don't you support this and that? I mean, I think there's two. I've got two answers for you. One of them, can I do two answers? Is that allowed?
Answers are multiple. Questions are one.
There we go. So on the one side, I think they're fantastic because anything that pushes the technological envelope and is constantly looking for new and better ways to do things is fantastic. That's wonderful. At the same time, I think that it's dilutive to the idea of Bitcoin and cryptographic currencies. If it's fragmenting an already fairly small adopter community, I don't think that's so good. I think that the idea behind Bitcoin is incredibly valuable in terms of what it can do to accelerate commerce across boundaries, and those boundaries are various types, you know, socioeconomic boundaries, world boundaries, you name it. I think that idea is the most powerful part of what Bitcoin is, and I'd hate to see the community so fragmented across a bazillion different, you know, altcoins that you can't achieve what Bitcoin can achieve. And I do fear that there's a whole lot of folks who are creating new alt currencies just for the pump and dump value, and that's no value to the world.
Yeah, let me just add, can anybody look up the difficulty factor on the Litecoin network and then compare that with the difficulty factor on the Bitcoin network? Yeah, so the Bitcoin network, I believe the difficulty, which is an indicator of the size of the computing network behind Bitcoin, is around 65 million. And I don't know, a few months ago I checked, it was like in the hundreds for the Litecoin network. So what that fundamentally means is that Bitcoin is a far, far more secure payment method than Litecoin because it has more computers providing that security. So if you then look at what gives all forms of money their value, it's their utility and exchange, and you say that Bitcoin is the most secure payment method available, the most counterfeit-proof method available, you can draw your own conclusions about what that means for the alternative currencies. So I think innovation will happen in some of the alternative currencies that'll get adopted into Bitcoin if there's something significant enough that makes it worth it. But that's kind of my view on the alternative coins.
So in terms of Bitcoin specifically and the cryptography used in Bitcoin and not the other ones, what keeps you up at night as a developer in terms of what do you need to strengthen so that the whole thing doesn't come falling down?
Well, it's not the core. It's more of like networking things and that sort of thing. One of the favorite journalist questions is about what happens if you own a 51% of the mining power. That's called a 51% attack. And no one really cares about that at all as a developer because it's just so unrealistic. It'll cost, you know, hardware cost. If you wanted to attack the Bitcoin network, you're looking at spending over $300 million, which is far beyond the military defense budgets of many countries. So, but, you know, the attack surfaces, if, you know, you look at what's cheap to launch an attack, and I'm not going to give you a point-by-point list, but networking is, you know, much bigger attack service than the theoretical cryptographic algorithms, elliptic curve, SHA-256 hash. Those things are going to be broken, you know, sometime in the distant future, but network attacks are much more viable today.
One thing I forgot to mention was the Bitcoin network is the most powerful distributed computing network in the history of mankind. It's more powerful than any of the other distributed computing projects combined.
Yeah, or any supercomputer.
Yeah, it's more powerful than the top 500 supercomputers on planet Earth,
combined.
Last we checked.
Combined.
Yeah, combined.
get the mic. All right.
What do y'all think of the Bitcoin rising $20 in 2 days?
I think most of it's people trying to get their Bitcoins out of Mt. Gox. they're having Mt. Gox can't send dollars back to the United States right now. And so an exchange isn't very useful if you can't get actual money out of it. So the one way you can get money out of it is by converting it to Bitcoins and then transferring the Bitcoins out. So I think that's probably what's going on.
And what do y'all think that the 400 giga hash miners are going to affect the difficulty in mining a coin?
Yes.
Yeah.
How?
It's going to go up.
how like more difficult do you think it's going to be?
That's hard to say.
Yeah, there's plenty of people producing new mining hardware. People have millions in venture capital to do it now. The lead CPU designer from Samsung is at one of these mining hardware things, and the mining difficulty is going to triple, and then it's going to triple again, then it's going to triple again. That's one of the things that no one can predict. But we know it's going to go up, and we know it's going to go up by a lot.
Yeah, I think the market cap of ASIC Miner, which is one of the mining manufacturing companies, I think the market cap is over $1 billion, and they're traded on a completely illegal exchange.
I have a question, but I'm trying to organize it properly. So my main question is, in terms of tax revenue or how we pay the IRS or in other countries, do we treat Bitcoin transactions as a form of investment, or what sort of category would it be taxed as if, let's say, I had like a million Bitcoins and I held them and didn't sell them, and I held them for a while? Would that still be taxable if it's not money currently?
How did you acquire the Bitcoins?
Someone gave them to me.
All right. If somebody gave them to you, then it would theoretically be a gift. Therefore, they would be filing a gift tax return, and it would basically... they would be paying, if it goes in excess of a certain limitation, they would pay a gift tax to the United States. You now have your Bitcoins that you got as a gift, that's your basis, what they paid in gift tax, and then when you decided to sell them, you would potentially have a, and you sold them for whatever, if it's a gain based on their gift, just like anything else, you sell a gift, you have a taxable event. And when you sell it, you have a value realization. And when I'm saying selling it, I'm really saying translating it into a recognized usable currency like dollars, euros.
And what if you use it to buy something?
Well, if you use it for like a Bitcoin transaction, then...
yeah, you buy a car with it or something.
Okay, then pretty much that's... well, if you buy a car...
do you pay the capital gains between...
no, you don't pay the capital gains, but you do pay if you buy a car. You obviously are going to pay your state sales tax based on the value of the car.
Yeah.
The states aren't equipped to basically take Bitcoin, right? So, but when you pay it to the dealer, assuming it's a transaction at a dealer.
Or let's just say it's a used car that you're buying, but you're buying something instead of just turning it into dollars.
Right. If you're buying, then basically you buying is not the transaction. It's the person selling the car that's the transaction.
And so they have to report income.
And they have to report income and that. Why? Because it's the internal revenue code?
Yeah, it's not new.
It's not new.
Well, I mean, we're talking about the laws here, not whether or not you obey them.
Whether you comply, exactly. Whether you comply with the law, that's your problem or your issue. We're discussing what the law says. Okay, and the law says if you sell personal property at a gain, you pay an income tax. If you went and took Bitcoin and you bought land, all right, that's, and you now have a basis of land because the person selling the land to you said, I want $100,000 using US currency. You then hold that land. You sell it 5 years from now and you get the equivalent of $200,000 to $300,000 for that, whether in Bitcoin or in real currency. You now have an investment, you purchased land, you sold the land, you have a $200,000 gain, it's taxable. How you held the land, whether it was for investment or business purposes, will determine is it a capital transaction or ordinary income. But it's still taxable. And whether you report it or not is your issue. But trust me, there is, just in a land transaction, there's enough state paperwork and federal paperwork that it is traceable, that a government agency can go in and audit that transaction, whether you paid it in Bitcoin or dollars, no one cares.
And just as a personal plug, I am selling 3.3 acres of North Carolina land for Bitcoins.
And he'll pay tax on it.
And the land title reminds me of something very important to talk about with Bitcoin. Bitcoin is not just a point-to-point payment protocol. You can do more elaborate transactions, like require 3 out of 5 people to sign a transaction. And the technology can also be used for things like recording title. So we could actually do decentralized titles to cars and land using the Bitcoin technology. And I think we will one day.
Mike's in the back.
So my question is, it's more from a legal perspective, is what hurdles do you see coming up? And since being that it's a completely virtual currency with Bitcoins, where illegal or just, I guess, maybe being able to keep track of what happens if it's just completely contained within the Bitcoin world, if there's never really an exit point, being that there's no personal information of the end users being accounted for.
Well, I think that what we had talked about earlier is that it is, with enough effort, it can still be traced back to you. So even though within the system, it might not track your name and your address, the ways that you, as you mentioned, someone else on the panel mentioned, the ways that you get in and out of the Bitcoin economy are generally have some sort of identifying information about you, because you're typically going to, you know, unless you're meeting some person on the street and giving them cash for the coins, you're going to have somewhere at least some sort of information about you. And then, as someone else mentioned, there are things that you do outside of the system.
That's probably the hardest.
Think about the actual transaction that takes place. I mentioned the Starbucks example where you could buy coffee completely anonymous, and there's a lot of reasons you might want to do that. And there are a lot of different types of transactions that you might want to conduct completely anonymously for completely legitimate reasons. But if you're buying a car, let's say, are you really going to do that anonymously and not know who you're buying that car from, and they not know you? You're going to reveal yourself at certain points, regardless of whether you're using Bitcoin or cash to do that transaction. So the idea that you would have complete anonymity by staying completely within the Bitcoin network is, it's just not the case. I mean, there's other stuff you're going to have to do, right? And it just depends on the kind of transaction, who you're transacting with, who your counterparty is, how much of your personal information is revealed to somebody. And then if it's revealed to somebody, they could reveal it to somebody else, or to a government, or to, you know, a regulator or whatever.
Though I would add that, you know, it's a good general mental model just to think of Bitcoins as electronic cash. It's not like a credit card. It's not like a debit card. It's not like a bank account. Mm. It's like cash. If you lose it, it's gone. If someone steals your electronic wallet, it's just like if someone picked my pocket and stole my wallet. Possession is 10/10 of reality. So the mental model, the legal model, it's electronic cash.
Yeah, and like any new disruptive technology that comes in, it's going to take the government a little while to catch up on how they want to regulate it, how they want to enforce the laws around it. But in general, your best bet is to assume that whatever you're doing with Bitcoin, you're doing it with cash, because that's probably where it's going to end up from a legal standpoint.
I paid for my badge here in cash, but they still made me fill out that form, so they know who I am. So I gave up my anonymity that I otherwise would have had I not filled out that form. So there's an example of an anonymous transaction method, cash.
All right, well, it's a big one.
Two more questions.
The G20 currently is organizing tax codes among the first world and most of the world, trying to stamp out, you know, transnational tax shelters. What if Russia or Iran started selling oil in Bitcoin? How would that change the Western central bankers' hegemony?
It won't. Has no effect.
I think geopolitics is probably up beyond the scope of what we're talking about here.
Well, no, I mean,
you know, some countries have tried to do that with gold, right? And we saw the results of that.
I mean, it has really no effect.
Would there some conjecture over it? Again, some unforeseen consequences.
if I ran transfers from the dollar to euro, basically the dollar probably will get stronger and the euro is going to drop. So if we say that Bitcoin is based on a dollar currency, which it's not, you know, so they have no effect. No.
That's good.
When I was reading about Bitcoin online, it reminded me of something that years ago was very popular, SETI at home, where people would download chunks of information, process them, and send them back.
Yep.
And I was wondering if the anonymous person who created Bitcoin may have created it to process and to harness. I mean, is it possible that someone could be harnessing the Bitcoin network to process data for some other person reason besides cash?
No.
So no, the sole purpose of the computing that they're doing is to synchronize all the computers around the world with each other on the Bitcoin ledger. The algorithm that they're computing has no value outside of that.
Okay, and so all the source code is it's open source, so you can read through the code and determine what they're doing with your computing power if you're running the code.
Okay, so it's dedicated to create the cash, and there's no maybe underlying reason
to
for
secure the payments. Okay. To secure the payments.
Okay. Well, thank you.
Go ahead.
Very quick question.
I'm not here, so
each panelist, what do you think is the percentage chance that a U.S. regulatory authority will try to shut down all Bitcoin exchange in the U.S.? Just the percentage chance.
Very low.
Very, very low.
Almost zero.
Non-existent.
Thank you.
Now, if you added the word illegal to that question, then I'd say that it's 100%. I mean, they're going to do everything they can to squash illegal behavior, but I don't think they're disincented to shut it down because it's, I mean, what's
now
the motivation?
But I agree
taxes.
That I agree that, but that's not a Bitcoin issue, right? They're always going to try and stop illegal activity completely separately from Bitcoin.
Right.
So yeah, I completely agree.
They've got enough bad guys out there. Why go after the good guys for no good reason?
I mean, they may regulate it, or they may create regulations, which are interesting. Illegal activity, the government's going to go after. Any government is going to go after. Illegal activity, they're not, you know, they just want to make sure everything's legal.
They've got enough to do already.
Right. I'm sorry, but our time is up. Thank you for coming. And